You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Who Cares About the Rock Hall, a podcast about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm your host, Joe Quazala. With me, as always,
Kristen Studdard.
Hi, Kristen.
That is me. Hello.
Hello. How are you feeling?
Pretty good. It's warm. Listeners don't care, but it's warm.
No, they don't. They could be anywhere.
They could be anywhere.
All across the world, we have listeners, or so a website told me once.
I wonder where the coldest place we have a listener is right now.
If you're cold right now, write in rockhallpod@gmail.com.
Truly please.
We're very excited to have our guest with us here today. He is many things. I'm prepared to say multi-hyphenate.
Ooh.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. Culture writer, professor, author, DJ, podcast host, Oliver Wong.
Wow.
Hello.
Pleasure to be with y'all.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You know, I have to say the first time I saw you was on, I don't know if we've talked about this on air, but the PBS documentary Soundbreaking.
I don't think we have talked about it on air. I think that was all just chatter off,
yeah,
off
but
the record.
I brought it up to you because yes. And we've watched a little bit of it because I'm a big fan. That's where I saw it. And I was like, I like what this guy is saying.
What is the thing? It's like a documentary series.
Produced by George Martin.
Not RR.
No, not RR.
That'd be kind of awesome,
yeah,
though.
Yeah.
That would explain why we still don't have a new book.
Ouch.
Yeah, because He's off producing music documentaries. No, it was produced by George Martin, who was a longtime producer for the Beatles. And it is just an in-depth, really well-made documentary about music.
Oh.
Yeah, in fact, I think we taped it at a studio soundstage, actually not far from where we're all sitting right now. So.
Oh, shit.
Yeah,
okay.
Not too far from here.
Yeah.
In its many parts?
Yes.
Does each of them have a theme?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like, there's one segment that's just about the way we listen to music. There's one...
Like, the modes in which
yes,
we listen to it. So,
right.
Like, the Walkman, vinyl, etc.
From, you know, or the phonograph to streaming.
Gotcha.
You know? And then, you know, there's an episode that's about producers, just like, you know, people...
Well, that's why we watch it, because we watch it with the Nile Rodgers. Right before we went to go see him.
Yeah.
He's a fun hang. I've never hung with him, but I can just imagine his fun hang. But
oh,
he
really
can talk.
Like
he's
yes.
such a good talker. Yeah.
We saw Sheik and yes. they were he was just
he was awesome. His drummer is also a good talker though,
okay.
too.
Good to know.
Yeah. But Oliver, you are someone who I when I was watching you, I was like, this guy knows how to talk about music, which is and I was like, that is perfect for our podcast. And so the first thing I want to ask you, and this is the kind of the question that we do always to kind of get us into it.
The raison d'être to our podcast.
Is just what you're coming into this podcast in terms of knowledge about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And kind of your thoughts and opinions. And as someone who writes about music for many different publications, it is
right.
at the very least on your periphery, if not something that you know about with right. some authority. Right.
So we were talking a little bit about this before we started taping, and I mean, there's a couple layers to this. I guess I should first kind of pre-qualify or just qualify some of my remarks. I've actually done a gig for the Hall of Fame. This was, I think, maybe about 5 years ago, where they did a tribute to Aretha Franklin. And I was brought out to DJ kind of like the pre-night event as part of that, which is to say I've been paid by them. So this disclosure
okay.
purposes.
He's on the Hall's payroll.
You know, I've had disclosure. Friends who and colleagues who've worked with them in different capacities over the years. I've visited the Hall. But in terms of what you and I were talking about beforehand, I think as someone who came into writing about music and thinking about music, not through the lane of rock music or its traditions, but really through hip hop, I think I've always had, like a lot of people who started in hip hop, kind of a chip on my shoulder towards what we think of as like these kind of classic rock institutions that have always been very gatekeepy when it comes to not just hip hop, but arguably just around black music in general, or at least certain kinds of black music. And I think
anything after 1960.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Right. Decent representation from the early days of rock when it comes to black artists. But then after that, it gets spotty, to say the least.
Right. So I think I've always approached the kind of canon making qualities of the Hall similar to how I think of the Grammys, which is I don't really put a lot of stock into them. I don't give them a lot of authoritative, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Authority?
Yeah, I guess maybe that's, I should not have turned into an adjective. Yeah. I don't see them as a particularly meaningful authority, at least from my perspective as a music writer and a music scholar, even though I recognize that to other people it's very important. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things
really
where...
One guy in particular.
No, I think that's probably more than just one. Because
other guys' dads. Sorry.
Well, I have a lot of friends and colleagues who are they get ballots, and so every year, you know, when the nominees come out and when the voting process is, you know, social media is just filled with like the same kind of debates over and over.
Yeah.
Which I think are meaningful to a certain degree, but again, I don't personally put a lot of stock in it, mostly because I see the Rock. I see the Hall of Fame in similar ways as I see, like I said, the Grammys, which is that y'all never really cared that much about sort of the music and the artists I care for. And so whether you let like us in or not is less meaningful to me as a consequence of it. But I totally get why it's fun to argue about, because mm-hmm. I understand that canon, like the act of trying to make a canon and decide around inclusion or exclusion, mm-hmm. like these are inherently debatable topics.
You did an Aretha tribute, yes?
I was part of a weekend long Aretha tribute. This
when
was back
she was alive.
Yes, this was back.
Okay,
I was
like, because there has been some of my personal drama with the Hall around the Aretha.
The induction ceremony this year should have had an Aretha tribute because she had died, but there was not one,
it
which
did
was
not
surprising.
Have one?
Was it a timing? I don't remember.
No, because they did the stupid singles category. I mean, I thought you meant like, was there not enough time in the broadcast? There's always enough time. I'm so angry about this.
My big thing
lately about that. They did a whole, and I've said this many times, but I will say it one final. This won't be the last time I say it. They did a Chris Cornell tribute.
He got an
entire dirge of Black Hole Sun sung by Ann
Wilson
from Heart
and Jerry Cantrell from Alice in Chains.
And
the issue with that is that Chris Cornell's not in the Hall of Fame.
He's not even in the Hall of Fame. Aretha is the first woman who was ever inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
You know, when you look at the history of the Hall's tribute performances after people die...
Bowie got one.
I mean, Bowie makes sense, but also the fact that, like, Glenn Frey from the Eagles got one...
Wait,
and
what?
Aretha did not.
I do not remember Glenn Frey getting one. Did I see that? Have I ever seen that?
It was, like, Sheryl Crow and somebody else. It was...
That does seem bizarre.
Was this
though.
When all the women came out, like Emmylou Harris and?
No, that was Linda Ronstadt.
Okay, I do remember that one.
Yeah, well, that was good. You remember it because it was good. You don't remember the Glenn Frey? It was they did like New Kid in Town, and it was just kind of sleepy.
Now I'm even more angry.
Yeah,
it's just the gall of these motherfuckers. Like
truly. I mean, like
because my big vision, and I don't really care about the hall until then I start talking about this particular things that make me mad, which is like my big vision for the whole ceremony this year was like, I'm like, they're going to open with this beautiful Aretha tribute.
Which you really should have been.
Beyonce is going to be there. Michelle Obama is going to be there. Like everybody.
Yeah, I think your theory was that George Michael would come back from the dead and sing I Knew You Were Waiting.
That'd be amazing.
And sing I Knew You Were Waiting with her. Yeah. Yes, that is.
With her hologram.
With her hologram. I like really believe that there was no way they were going to pass up an opportunity to, you know, A, honor the first woman that they ever inducted, and B, get on the diversity tip a little bit more.
Especially given Janet wasn't performing. Was a big, if I may call it, a whoopsie.
Wait, now did they think that they had already taken care of it because they did this thing that you DJed 5 years ago?
Well, yeah, so this was at the museum, right, Oliver?
It was. Cleveland? Yeah, I think they had, I remember... the night that I DJed, I basically was the opener for MC Light, who followed me. And then on the actual night of the event, Chaka Khan was one of the main performers. And then Aretha came out and sang a couple of songs, which was kind of awesome. As
someone who's
a lifelong Aretha fan, like I'd never seen her live. And even if it was just for like 10 minutes, like I will take those 10 minutes. So
yeah.
But that does seem actually utterly bizarre that they wouldn't
also,
have done something.
Just also some very big shade to have Chaka come and perform at the damn Hall of Fame, considering the amount of times that she has also been nominated, including last year, and not inducted.
Well, I think that actually kind of points to the fact that the museum...
That the hall would like her in.
The museum and then the people who do the induction ceremonies are separate entities.
Right.
And the museum, you know, they don't have to induct anybody, so they can invite whoever they want, you know, and they can they kind of get that freedom.
But, you know, much like with the Grammys, much like with the Academy, you know, it's the voting base, much like America.
Ooh,
it's the voting base that sometimes presents, you know, the challenge to these things, right? So
no, I would say for sure. I mean, because if you look at, let's say, hip hop, I think actually the nominating committee has done a decent job.
Yes.
But it's when the ballot gets to the voters that we have issues. Right. And to give credit where it's due, Public Enemy, Run DMC, Tupac all got in as soon as they were eligible. They're what we call FYEs, first year eligible acts. And that is that was done correctly. Now, then you look at the other three acts that are in, which is Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Beastie Boys, and NWA. It took them about three or four ballots apiece, which, you know, maybe you could argue they should have gotten in as soon as they were eligible, but they still did eventually get in. LL Cool J, who has been at this point nominated five times, was nominated back in 2010 when he first became eligible.
Yeah.
And can't seem to get past that second step. And then, you know, they've put up Afrika Bambaataa once. They put up Eric B. and Rakim once. And once it gets to the voting body, that's where we seem to have our issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do believe my prediction is that Notorious B.I.G. will be nominated and immediately inducted this coming induction cycle.
Tupac got in, right? Yeah, we talked about
it. Right.
He literally just said that like 10 seconds ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
right.
I'm just an FYE.
Making sure. Yeah.
So it's interesting to see where this is going to go, because we're also going to catch up pretty quickly, because, you know, Biggie is eligible for this cycle.
And then it's Jay-Z next year.
And then Jay-Z is the next, so is it going to be too enticing to induct Jay-Z before you get to someone like LL, or this entire backlog of hip-hop artists that come before that? Because we're rolling up to 94, and then with Jay-Z, it's 95 for eligibility.
Well, that would also bring Wu-Tang, right?
So Wu-Tang's already eligible. Tribe is already eligible.
Mobb Deep. I mean, y'all already did a Tribe show, if I remember, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Has Tribe been nominated yet?
No. I have mentioned everyone who's been nominated.
Right. I think Tribe will have a harder time getting nominated. I think we'll get into this when we get into De La Soul too, but it's just kind of like conscious rap from the 90s, late 80s. It's harder. Just like, I don't think it penetrated old white culture as much.
I'm not sure NWA did either, except to piss people off in that demographic.
But did, in as far as like it became a national name, like NWA, because Fuck the Police was such a big, there was that huge trial and all that stuff, you know, like they weren't, and that was like part of the fight for like labeling of the thing.
I think you
that,
might be conflating it with Cop Killer.
Two Life Crew definitely was
that
one.
Was the big, that was
and
the
then,
big free speech.
Ice-T's Cop Killer.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But didn't I wasn't NWA?
I mean, I'm sure.
I mean, the movie
Tipper
helped.
Gore was upset with, you know, Fuck the Police.
Right.
But, I mean, Straight Outta Compton helped them. The movie helped. But
I mean,
like
that's really what.
But
got
I do
NWA
think that
in.
Like we knew what NWA was, and also Ice Cube becoming like a
family friendly
movie star.
But then why not LL, whose movie career at this point has long eclipsed, I think, his musical career.
Very good point.
So,
yeah.
But
I think that I said this on his episode, which is that I think though he has in it's not like Ice Cube. I think still because his music career was like harder and he was more of a like a gangster than LL was. In spite of, you know, Mama said knock you out. I think that like LL almost. People don't think of him as a rapper as much anymore.
Right, right.
And I don't think necessarily that people don't think of Ice Cube as a rapper anymore, but I think that they, it's like this weird respect for him having been
part of NWA.
Yeah, and part of NWA
yeah.
back then. I think that that might be the thing that's keeping LL.
Not to get too off tangent here, I would actually give, I think, Tribe decent odds. If at least they get nominated, I think they probably stand a pretty good chance because I think of that early 90s generation, maybe they're not quite at the stature of, let's say, a Biggie who loomed larger than life partly because of his death. But I think someone like Tribe was so universally loved and respected in ways that, again, I would see them probably having an easier shot than maybe even someone like a De La, even though... I think De La's qualifications for this, and I'm sure we're going to get into this mm-hmm. in a moment, I think are slightly different than Tribe's are going to be, even though they're very much, you know, they come from the same clique, of course. But Tribe to me, it's like, if you were to have looked in some random, you know, middle America's CD collection in 1993, you probably would have found like The Chronic there, and you probably would have found like Low End Theory or Midnight Marauders.
If they had a teenager of a certain age.
Okay.
I think The Chronic, like that permeated everybody. It was on the damn radio. You know what I mean? Like Tribe never had that kind of like, as more like, I think Q-Tip as a personality mm-hmm. maybe broke through more. I mentioned his Budweiser ads from the 90s.
Oh, I don't even remember those.
Which were like, you don't remember those?
Q-Tip did Budweiser ads?
Well, the song.
He
a song.
He had a vibrant thing.
Oh, okay, okay.
Was part of a Budweiser.
Yeah, he wasn't shilling
He wasn't
beer.
Just right, like right. with a beer in the ad. But like, I do remember that was like the first time I heard Vibrant Thing was like...
Right.
Well, I get what you're saying, Oliver, though, which is that, you know, Tribe was extremely respected and was kind of like a critical darling.
Right.
And they are not difficult to love.
Right.
Kind of across the board. I think they are, you know, with the way The Hall handles hip hop, it's kind of like the biggest, most famous names are the ones that are getting in first, and then eventually we will have to deal with like, okay, where do we go from there as we like get away from the absolutely iconic acts?
Right.
You know, there are also acts that are deserving that are maybe
and we
on
keep
a
keep clearing out the 60s and 70s. Just, you know, we put
except for Rufus and Chaka Khan apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, eventually, I think Rufus and Chaka Khan will get in before right. any conscious rap from the night. From the like, I just because of who the voting body is and the way that like their even awareness of these bands is so
well, because part of the problem is you're thinking like, okay, now who is every member of Def Leppard who was just inducted now has a ballot, you know, every member of the Zombies. Like, now these are the, and, you know, Janet has a ballot. Great. That's one versus,
she has a,
like,
single ballot.
The 10 people plus that I just mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, and those are the people who are voting. That's the bulk of the voting body, is these old white musicians.
See, this is why you need to induct Wu-Tang, because then you get 8 people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Rest in peace, ODB. But, right, you get 8 people with ballots, and then, you know, that begins to move, shift the demographic a little bit.
Yeah.
This is like Evelyn's thing. It's like why the Go-Go's need to get in. It's like we just need to
there
diversify,
you go. Exactly.
You know?
Or, yeah, that's it. That's an interesting thing, too, is that typically black artists, it tends to be, black or female artists, it tends to be solo artists. Whereas, you know, you don't have the, even like the Commodores are not in.
How about Earth, Wind & Fire?
Earth, Wind & Fire is.
They no, they are. They, yeah. That's right. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But, you know, that was nearly 20 years ago. And, you know, from kind of that era, we've done okay with those groups. But Kool & the Gang, you know, still not in there. And I think, you know, there's a decent case to be made.
Kool & the Gang is not in?
No, they're not.
I also, it's just because of the hatred. I mean, like, disco and funk, I just think they're also, again, you have the thing. It's like people think that they know what rock and roll is. They're like, I know it when I see it. And it's a white guy with a guitar. Full stop. Like, that's what they think it is.
Although I think if a band, because the Commodores and Kool & the Gang were both bands that were very popular, huge. Everybody knows who they are. I think that type of name recognition could carry them from the ballot to
the grave. And they're not. And you can't
vote
once.
No, to the class, Kristen. I do, because I think they're
a lot of problems with some posthumous black artists.
Yeah. Right.
Like.
Yeah. Well,
again, it's like Biggie will get in and then he won't get to vote. Will right. Will Faith Hill get his ballot? Like, what's going to happen?
Faith Hill. Jesus Christ.
That'd be awesome if Faith Hill got Biggie's ballot.
Faith Hill got Biggie's ballot.
Yeah. Do you think Wu are going to be first year inductees?
No, because they've already been eligible.
Oh, so they haven't been nominated yet.
They have not been nominated.
No. So what's the acronym?
So FYE for first year eligible.
Eligible.
But then we do FYN for first year nominated. So, like, okay. If by the time Wu-Tang finally gets on the ballot,
for them. When they get on the ballot, Wu-Tang will get in. You don't.
You're not positive they would get in on that first.
On that first ballot, it really depends on who else is on the ballot.
It's going to be in 10 years, and by then they'll be like, "Oh yeah."
I think Wu-Tang and I think Tribe and I think De La are going to be within the first 15 hip hop acts inducted. Now we only have 6 at this point, and we don't necessarily get one every year.
Right.
So we're talking, you know. We'll get into that later, but, you know, there's the way I would break it down. The 6 that we have in now: Grandmaster Flash, Run DMC, Beastie Boys, Public Enemy, NWA, and Tupac. Right? I think Biggie's going to be next, and then, I mean, if you look at the who becomes eligible, you've got Jay-Z, you've got Eminem. Outkast became eligible last year. I think they're going to be in the mix. I think you're going to have
to get them in the mix.
You're going to have
get them in the mix.
You're going to have to get LL in there at some juncture, right? So that takes us to 10.
Yeah.
And
then who comes in that next wave after
and then
that?
Yeah, the wave after that I think is going to be Tribe, Missy Elliott, De La, Wu-Tang, Snoop Dogg.
Missy is going to be the first and only woman.
I think
for a long time.
Salt and Pepper has a shot.
They're going to be
that's
second.
I think that's a super long shot. Yeah, yeah. That's going to be third wave.
Yeah,
I could maybe see Lauren ahead, but is one album going to be enough? Maybe not.
She performed in the Nina Simone tribute 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that she showed up at all is, she's playing the game a little bit.
Yeah.
Oliver, I want to know why you picked De La Soul.
I mean, I think, let's see. Number one, it's because they're the most formative group in not just my kind of hip hop history, but just in my musical history, period. And I think that for the purposes of talking about something like the Rock Hall, they make for, I think, there's a strong case to be made for them, to the extent that I'm inclined to want to do it for the reasons why I'm ambivalent about arguing about inclusion to begin with. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot of things about De La that make them, I think, a very attractive candidate for that. And so it's a combination of the personal, but also in taking the conceit of the show seriously, who do I actually think would make, you know, a compelling argument? As opposed to like plucking a far more obscure, you know,
who does your heart say? Who's in your heart's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Meaning what? Like,
if you could, if you just wanted, like, if you were like, this, I think is the most, is the best rapper or rap group alive, or like, I think this is the best, this is my favorite thing. And
De La would still fulfill that, right? And I mean, had you not already done a Tribe One, maybe I would have picked them. But again, De La, they came out earlier, and I think partly because. And I can get into this now if you want. The way I discovered De La Soul is, so I grew up in L.A. of the 1980s. And at the time, I was listening to a lot of modern rock. There's a radio station out here in Los Angeles, KROQ, K-Rock, which was the, and still remains, like the definitive kind of alternative rock, yeah, and modern rock station, new wave station here in Los Angeles. So when I was earlier in high school, I was listening to stuff like Erasure, New Order, Depeche Mode. It's what like my older cousin listened to. I'm Asian American, so it's kind of like required that if you were living in California in the 80s and you're Asian, you listen to modern rock. But K-Rock used to play De La. And not like Me, Myself, and I. They played, if I don't have this wrong, they played Three is the Magic Number, which is the first De La song I heard. I did not hear Me, Myself, and I until later. And I had been introduced to hip hop a couple of years before that. I had a friend from middle school, Joe Man Wong, shout out to Joe Man, who, when I was a freshman in high school, so this would have been around 1986, 87, gave me a cassette tape that he had dubbed License to Ill by the Beastie Boys on one side and then Run DMC's Raising Hell on the other. And I loved that. Like, I played that thing to static. But I was young. I didn't know a lot about music. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that this was like a genre of music. And ergo, if I really liked what I heard, I could go find other things.
Yeah.
Just didn't. Never occurred
to me. Also, what a combo, like Beastie Boys on one side, Run DMC. I mean, it's just like, that is such a sound. That is such a, like, you know, like East Coast,
Def Jam.
Yeah.
It just never occurred to me that, oh, this was great. Maybe I should go back to Joe Man and be like, dude, hook me up with whatever else sounds like this. Yeah. It just didn't occur to me.
Side two.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, that was side one and two. I didn't need volumes three and four at that point.
Exactly.
So I didn't really discover hip hop in that point. So then about three years go by and I'm listening to K-Rock and then they start playing Three's the Magic Number. And I'm like, what is this? Like, who is this group? This sounds really cool.
Maybe you can subtract it. You can call it your lucky partner. Maybe you can call it your adjective. But odd as it may be, without my one and two, where would there be my three mates passing me? And that's the magic number.
They're sampling Schoolhouse Rock.
Right.
Yeah.
And which is something that, you know, if you had been like, if you were a 70s baby like myself, you would have grown up watching that. And I must have read a review someplace about 3 Feet High and Rising, which was the group's debut album. And I don't even remember where that would have been. But I went, I think, if I have my memory's right, I went to Moby Disc, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was
a record store
in East Pasadena, which is close to where I grew up. And bought the album. This was the summer of 1989 when I got this.
What format did you buy it on?
I bought it on cassette. And was instantly smitten. And that album, it was not the first album I ever bought, but it was the first album that I bought that made me want to listen to everything else that I thought might sound like this. And it was really I mean, 3 Feet High and Rising was my gateway into hip hop, which then became my gateway into becoming a DJ. It was a gateway into what I got interested in as a student and then later as a scholar. It certainly is what helped launch me into the world of writing and journalism. Like, it all really stemmed from that album and from that group. But to bring this back to like our core point here, because De La was seen as being like this alternative hip hop act, right? That was how they were largely billed at the time, much to their own chagrin. That's why a station like K-Rock would play them in a way where you are not going to hear Boogie Down Productions on K-Rock. K-Rock is not playing Eric B. and Rakim. They did play White Lines by Grandmaster Flash and Melly Mel. Like, that was definitely in their rotation.
Really? I think that's so interesting to imagine K-Rock playing that.
Yeah, it almost feels as arbitrary. Like, why one group and not another?
I think some of that early 80s stuff makes a little bit more sense, partly because I'm thinking of just the ways in which, like, the downtown New York music scene of the 80s could be inclusive of, like, Blondie and Grandmaster Melly Mel and, like, you know, whoever else. I mean, there was just so much going on that was part of, like, this kind of no-wave scene there that hip-hop was kind of included on in the margins. And I think K-Rock might have been influenced by some of that. But again, they were not playing what we would consider mainstream hip-hop. You were not going to hear N.W.A. I could be wrong. I don't think K-Rock was playing N.W.A.
It had to exist in, like, this alternative
right category. But De La mapped. And so because of that, that's how I discovered De La Soul. And, wow, you know, they functioned in that moment around the late 80s. They were acceptable to stations that typically didn't play black music and certainly typically didn't play hip hop.
I feel like K-Rock today would play White Lines just because of like I just mean it. I mean, like,
K-Rock today is playing Imagine Dragons and
I guess
nothing
I'm
else.
I'm thinking of it as like a novelty that they would do it, like in a way, like Shaun of the Dead or is it Hot Fuzz? In one of those movies, one of those Edgar Wright movies, they do like a whole big White Lines thing. And I just think that, like, kids who like rock, I think that White Lines map, there is something about that song that really feels, I just could see them being like, and now.
Interesting.
A but, crazy, you know, throwback, fun.
I don't think you, they would ever do that.
I also don't listen to the radio anymore, so maybe.
Yeah. And I don't listen to K-Rock anymore these days. Yeah. But I think if you spin back to the 80s, you can imagine a song like White Lines fitting perfectly next to something like, you know, like Queen's, what's the one with the great bass line?
Oh, another one.
Another Bites the Dust.
And it would fit alongside something like Just Can't Get Enough by Depeche Mode. Mm-hmm. Like, they all have very similar production and sounds to it. So I think it made a lot more sense in the 80s.
Oh, wow. Honestly, that's a great... play those. That's a rock block, baby.
There it is.
Those three songs in a row.
Yeah. I'm sure I'm not the first person to ever come up with those three songs and comboed.
And specifically with that Queen bass line.
Of course.
Is the Nile Rodgers.
Of course.
You know, Good Times, which then was...
It all
Sugar
goes back
Hill
to
Gang.
Chic, really. Yeah. It really all goes back
often,
to Chic.
Often it does, we found.
Shout out to Niall. Yeah.
Shout out to Niall. Niall, musical excellence.
Yep, he's an inductee. So that's interesting. That's your gateway. Was 3 Feet High and Rising the first thing you wrote about?
No. I didn't start writing about music in any kind of professional, I use that with scare quotes, until I think probably around 1995 is when I first started writing about music for outlets. Though I was writing about music, this is pre-World Wide Web, but it's after the internet had been kind of introduced, at least on college campuses, I discovered news groups. And so, and there used to be two major hip-hop oriented ones, alt.rap and rec.music. Yes. Dash Hip Hop, I think, if I have it right. Uh-huh. And that's where I first started reviewing albums, was just writing on these news groups about my impressions about different stuff. That, I mean, and then you got to remember, this is all during the early 90s. So even though we may not have been calling it the golden era, it was definitely like a really good era to be writing about new hip hop releases. I got a lot of stuff wrong in that era. Like, I called Illmatic, I think, slightly overrated, which is an opinion I have completely like retreated upon these days.
Good.
But I realized in hindsight that even before I started getting paid to write about music, writing about music for news groups is where I first started writing for a public audience of any sort. So, you know, I'm kind of, even though I have a whole life pre-internet as a 70s kid, I still got my start writing because of the internet.
Oh, wow. How quaint.
Yes, isn't it, though?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's really interesting to think, too, that I bet people would, like, you know, log on or, you know, dial up to like read what you had to say about a thing. You know what I mean? You could get, it's like Twitter. It's like you could get these niche followings.
Totally.
You know,
right.
Kind of in these interesting ways. Nas, is he
you know the answer to
eligible. I know
eligible?
That he's not in.
I
good God.
Be like, is
Joe
Nas
really
in?
Gave I think... me I know that he's not in. I was at, is he eligible?
I don't know when Nas's first release was.
Is it first album release?
It's first it's first record. Like it could be it's a single that makes someone eligible.
Okay. So then that would probably be Halftime off the Zebrahead soundtrack, and that would have been either 92 or 93.
So he became eligible recently.
Okay. I mean, yeah. I don't I was just thinking like, well, when is that? What's the like? When's the Nas year gonna happen?
Yeah,
I feel like just thinking about people who kind of had like these really iconic, influential albums too, like in the Lauryn Hill vein. Where, just thinking about that, my exposure to De La Soul comes, as always,
from
through an ex-boyfriend. A lot of my musical knowledge and exposure has happened through
Shout out to all the exes who put us up on stuff.
Shout out Joran Gargello. And he was the one who, I mentioned this in the Tribe because he was also very into Tribe. He and Del the Funky Homo Sapien, Joe 100% did not believe was a real person, and now we know is the guy from fucking Gorillaz. So what are you gonna do? I remember getting it, like he would make these mixes for like road trips and stuff. And then he gave me a bunch of, like, I feel like we were making each other mix CDs probably at this point, and he gave me a bunch of De La, but I don't know much about them. I know like the iconic songs. I can recognize a De La Soul song, and I've listened to a few of their albums through, and they're one of the, I like have a love hate relationship with what they did by introducing skits into hip hop culture.
You could argue they're responsible.
I like hate skits on albums. I like hate it with my whole heart and soul.
Wow.
Yeah, I know exactly. So, but
are you not a comedian?
That's exactly why I hate skits, because rappers are not comedians.
It's like what a rapper's attitude. It would be like a rapper's attitude.
It'd be like
a comedian.
In between my things, I was like, and not let me lay some bars. Like, absolutely not. Like,
there's some comedians who do that, but. With you.
Donald Glover is the only one who can do it.
I am with you to a large extent, which is to say that I do think that there is a proliferation of really bad skits out there. But I think, like, I'm not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater to say that there are some good skits, and I'm here for those good skits.
What do you think is a good skit? And if you say a $20 sack pyramid, that is like the skit that people try to tell me is the best skit of all time.
It's an okay skit. I'm not mad at that one. I think the Where's My Killa Tape skit from the first Wu-Tang album.
That the Wu-Tang are like, okay, the people who I think can get away with skits in some way are De La Soul, because they do it as a concept generally, which I think is very cool. I like it. And then Kendrick. Like Good Kid, Mad City, like that was like a concept. Like you're learning a story through the skits.
Yeah,
I still hate them. I mean, if I never had to hear another voicemail from somebody, or
I'm like 85% with you,
or like a rapper and a comedian. Just like I talk about this all the time. Just like fucking, it'll like a song will end, and then they'll be like, "Here's 2 minutes of us talking misogynist shit." And I'm like, you ruined it. Why did you do this to me? Like, why? Why you got to get Jamie Foxx on your album, Kanye, to just fucking make a prank phone call and call some girl ugly? Like, I hate this.
I feel you.
You are making me so mad. So that my feelings about De La are like, they are to blame for the fact that this has proliferated because they did it
because they started it.
Yeah. They did a cool thing. What they did was cool. And like the concept of it being like a radio station is cool. And you're like seeing the character that you're meeting in these songs, you're like learning their story. It makes it a whole experience. And that also is really cool when it comes to like an album experience.
Sure.
Two people were listening to albums, and like that is really like, that's what I think about too with like Good Kid, Mad City, which is like an album. It is telling you a story. It's like, or to Pimp a Butterfly, it's like an album. It's telling you a story. The skits matter in general. Quit it. At least make them a separate fucking track.
Well, I'm with you on that. Just give me the way that I can skip. Track. I can
skip
past
exactly.
It.
If you don't want it, you can easily get
God,
rid of it.
I'm like, this song is 6.5 minutes long. It's like, no, it's 3 minutes of two dudes giggling at how fucking hilarious they think they are in a studio. Stop it.
Wow. And there you have it. A monologue from Kristen Sutter. skits. To be reconsidered.
Skits, get him out of here. Scram.
Well, Skits. You know, one of the things that makes talking about music, but also the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame specifically difficult, is that obviously music is subjective. It's hard to categorize these things in an objective way. But in an attempt to do that thing that I just said was impossible, I put together a list of criteria that I think if an artist does well in these categories, that they have a case for induction.
All right.
So we're going to take a little bit of a break, and when we come back, we're going to see how De La Soul stacks up. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. I hope you had a nice break. I hope over your break you remembered an old friend or some shit. Okay. So with De La Soul, they became eligible for the 2014 ceremony, and they have no hall connections that I see. I don't believe they inducted or have shown up or anything like that. So let's go through these categories, shall we, with De La Soul. The first category is critical acclaim. I would call De La Soul critical darlings. I think if you kind of look at the publications that De La Soul has been in,
oh sure,
they've done extremely well. You know, whether it's The Village Voice or it's Rolling Stone or what have you, this is a group that critics could. I don't know about relate to, but they're a group that critics could really appreciate.
Totally,
I guess is the word.
Yes. Yeah.
And the kind of the rubric we use to determine just how well a group is critically adored, we use the Rolling Stone 500 list.
Ugh.
500 greatest albums, and I should acknowledge.
You have to acknowledge it, Joe.
That we did. We had recorded some of this already.
I'm like, and you are barreling through, but
we are re-recording some of this. So I've already made Kristen guess. Maybe one of the more unbelievable things, probably on our podcast, has been lost, which is that I had Kristen guess where De La Soul was on the 500 list, and she, I believe, said 340.
I said 341. I said, I think 3 Feet and Rising is on it because I know that Rolling Stone likes, that makes them feel good about themselves to put that song on. It makes them feel good about themselves to put that album on the list.
Right.
And I said,
not too high.
I think it's going to be around 340. I said 341 was my guess. And then Oliver said,
I said I probably would have put it somewhere in the 300s as well.
And it's 346.
And which it's was 346. Amazing.
Which is really, right. Everybody cheered.
We popped champagne.
Fireworks went off.
Yeah.
And that might be what lost us the footage.
Yeah, we flew too close to the sun.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Right.
But so that album is, I would say, definitively a classic one. It's on every single list of the, you know, greatest albums, whatever you want to, however you want to do that. However you want to judge the classicness of an album, 3 Feet High and Rising across the board is going to be considered in that regard. And we've, you know, if we have to determine why 3 Feet High and Rising is so critically adored, it's likely both the inventiveness of the lyrically and production-wise.
Well, and something that Oliver had said the last time was basically too that they were being quirky and weird and interesting, and the fact that it wasn't just, you know, I'm the greatest rapper alive and here's how and why and here's why everyone who tries to step to me is a sucker. This is more like here's like the flow was very interesting. It was more intricate flow.
Yeah,
and the sampling to the.
If you want to speak to that, yeah. Oliver, like at that time, this album coming out, what that kind of meant in the context of hip hop.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest intervention that De La provided, it wasn't simply just the kind of creative energy that went into all the quirkiness of the album, which is certainly a big part of it, but it's also that if you looked at the landscape of what hip hop was like circa 1988-89 leading up to the release of the album, you know, it's dominated by these larger than life superhero MC figures, your LL Cool J's, your Kumo D's, your KRS-One's, Chuck D, Rakim, etc. And De La was not like any of those other guys. They were not, you know, and I mean posturing in a positive way here. They were not posturing in terms of being these superhero bulletproof MCs that were, you know, godlike figures. These were like nebbish nerdy guys from Long Island. Like, they'd even come from like a cool borough like Queens or or the Bronx or Brooklyn. They're coming from Long Island, and you know, they have a very famous lyric about how black medallions know gold. So they're not rocking chains. They're not appearing in music videos driving up in you know, Mercedes Benz or BMWs. They were like these kind of weird dudes who reveled in being weird and being different. And I think as a result of that, the biggest, you know, contribution that they made to hip hop of that era, besides kind of whatever lyrical and musical innovations they came up with, is they demonstrated that hip hop could be something different than what we were used to. And I think from a 2019 perspective, where hip hop can mean a thousand different things, that means seem unremarkable. But back in 1989, right, spinning back 20 years, it's hard to overstate how important it was for everyone else in hip hop or were interested in hip hop to realize, oh, hip hop can be something different than like what we see from LL Cool J or Big Daddy Kane. Hip hop can be weird. It can be different. It can be creative. It can go in all these other directions. And I think more so than really any other group of their era, De La transformed what we knew of what was possible from hip hop. And I think for no other reason, this is what makes them such an important group. Mm-hmm. In addition to the fact that, you know, we can get into this in a moment too, what they were doing musically in terms of sampling culture, they expanded way beyond the James Brown and the Parliament Funkadelic catalog, even though me, myself, and I was from a Funkadelic song.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they were sampling from Johnny Cash, from Schoolhouse Rock, from obscure 1960s doo-wop groups, from Hall & Oates, from the Turtles, which ended up being a bad thing because the Turtles sued them, and that kind of messed up sampling culture for ever after that. But in any case, they were really, really broadening the scope of like what was possible in so many different levels. I think for all of these reasons, this is what sort of makes 3 Feet High and Rising and De La in that moment so important. Even though I would argue that actually I think De La Soul is Dead is the more interesting album. We can get into that later if we want to.
Do you think that 3 Feet High being the one that is maybe more critically lauded or like that appears on this list is just because it just like precedent setting kind of? Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's much easier for first albums to kind of get that recognition. Mm-hmm. You know, it's much harder, I think, for second or third albums to mirror the same way.
Although I do feel like if there's a Beastie Boys album on the thing, it is probably Paul's Boutique and
ahead
not,
of License to
not
Ill.
Yeah,
License
they're
Ill.
both on there, but Paul's
they
Boutique
are?
is the one.
Ooh,
that,
can I guess where they
oh
are?
God, yeah,
okay,
sure.
Let's see, because we
I yeah,
real,
you, you're on a roll.
Yeah,
let's double down.
Real guess. I think Paul's Boutique is going to be like, oh boy, okay. Ooh, I think either like 112 or 180.
Okay.
I think, and License to Ill is also on there. Mm-hmm. Ooh, I think License to Ill is going to be like 275.
Okay. So I would say pretty solid. If you kind of split the difference of your two guesses.
Oh, is it in the 150s?
It's 156.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean,
yeah,
like you kind of.
That's. She's on a roll.
You had two numbers in there and you just had to kind of combine them, find the average.
Uh-huh.
And then License to Ill is at 219.
See, now that just seems too high to me.
Yeah, License to Ill should not be.
That doesn't need to be that high.
License to Ill honestly doesn't need to be on there, in my opinion. I think it's a good album, but like I think as for what it does, as far as like innovation is concerned,
right,
it's like.
Well, it's almost like you split the things that Oliver was talking about, which is that like, because 3 Feet High and Rising has the inventiveness that Paul's Boutique has, but License to Ill has the debut.
License to Ill is actually Hillary Clinton's new.
Right, she has transitioned careers. But License to Ill has that debut quality that is important.
Sure.
So it's, yeah, that's how I would characterize that. And we should mention that the Turtles controversy is really too bad because it fucked a lot of shit up for sampling,
yeah,
and especially for a pretty throwaway sample.
It appears on Transmitting Live to Mars on the 3 Feet High and Rising album, which is effectively like an instrumental skit. Like they could have easily just left it off, and it really would not have changed the album.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Karmically, they paid for having introduced skits to
the bane
rap albums, and you know, sorry, you get what you deserve.
Ouch.
Sometimes.
Ouch.
And they have said like we easily could have changed that. It would not have really changed much in that non-song track, and it could have saved a lot of trouble.
I will say this much, though. Sampling, because it was so ill-defined in terms of existing copyright law, it was going to come to a head with something.
Yes, of course.
Especially, if it wasn't this, it was going to be something else. It kind of sucks that it was for this, because you know, three feet High and Rising, and then I forget how many of those early De La albums, amazingly, are not on any streaming service, and it's because of sample clearance problems. And this is something that they as a group have talked very publicly about, because Tommy Boy Records, which released those albums and which still has, I think, the controlling interest in them, will not go through what needs to be done in order to make those albums available through your iTunes and your Spotify's or whatever else. And it's pretty wild to realize that an album of the stature of 3 Feet High and Rising, a bestseller, critically acclaimed, you can't find it anywhere.
No.
Not legally, at least.
So right. With this like sample clearance stuff, is it then, so you have to get these samples cleared, but then do they also, do you have to pay for every sample? Do they get a piece of the royalty?
How it depends on how that gets
generally
negotiated.
Okay.
Right. Usually you want to license it so you don't,
you don't have to,
no back end stuff. Yeah. But certain artists have been able to get sort of that concession. Usually if you forgot to clear it on the front end, as
then,
a back end penalty,
ooh, baby,
you
got to
give up.
Paying.
You
got
to give up points. Yeah,
and I've got to imagine the extent with which you use the track must have something to do with that.
It does, but it's. I mean, again, the copyright law on this is really, really ill defined. So it's really up to the negotiation. So I mean, again, with the Turtles, it was maybe half a bar. It's not like they're sampling like half the song.
Mm-hmm.
And
you,
yet,
you might not, even if you know that song, you might not even recognize that sample
right
within it.
Exactly. So the
I
length
think,
of it,
what they were banking on.
Right, right. It's really up to a jury or a judge to decide, and this is part of the kind of dangerous variances that have existed around copyright and sampling,
mm-hmm.
which we have yet to resolve, even though it's been like 20 plus years now.
So there isn't like a standard way to resolve it anymore?
Not really.
Yet.
I mean, there's court precedent, but that's not like copyright law has not officially stated, okay, X amount
Here
of time.
Is how you do this.
No, they won't touch it, or they haven't at least.
Definitively the classic album is 3 Feet High and Rising, but then you could make a case for the ones that come after that.
Yeah.
De La Soul is Dead, which is an interesting one because of the kind of reinvention aspect of it.
And I don't think any rap artist had done, I mean, there are rap artists who have made albums that are different from the ones that preceded it, but up until that point, I don't think any artist had basically said, we're going to reinvent ourselves by metaphorically killing off what everyone liked about our previous iteration.
Yeah, for our second album, too. This isn't like, you know, well, we've made five albums of this kind
of, for
you
a
know.
Change.
Like,
right. This is like, y'all loved our debut? Great. That's dead. Like, literally, we're saying
done.
De La Soul is dead. We're going to kill ourselves because we hate how everyone called us hippies, and we're going to reinvent ourselves. And I thought that was an incredible move. I mean, you know, 20 years later, it's still, or plus years later, that still seems like an incredible thing for them to have done, because you're basically giving up, in a sense, everything symbolically that people loved about you to begin with, and you're basically saying, fuck that.
Now, is the sound of De La Soul is Dead markedly different?
Not
than,
really.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a complete reinvention.
It was like a,
but it was more like
a nod
rhetorically.
To the fact of,
it was a rhetorical reinvention.
Because they were upset with, like you said, being called hippies.
Right.
They, and it was mostly because I think there were flowers on the album cover.
Right, and they had the whole thing about the Daisy Age, which was an acronym. And so, I mean, it's not crazy to understand why people labeled them as hippies, but it was definitely not a label
they
embraced.
Well, listening to their music, it is pretty laid back. Mm-hmm. It's a chill vibe music.
And feel good, right.
Yeah.
And it has like that kind of like, very whimsical feel to
me,
to it.
It feels very California. You know what I mean? Like, that's why I was,
I could see that.
It feels it's got like a more of a West Coast vibe.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's sunnier, maybe.
Yeah.
You could say.
Yeah. Long Island has beaches. So, you know,
the sun shines on Long Island.
There you go.
For sure.
Just the same.
Kind of connected to that streaming thing. So the next category is iconic recognizable songs. And obviously I would say Me, Myself, and I is the big one. That's the one that everyone knows.
Yeah.
That's,
which is a song they don't even like. They'll play it in shows, but they'll say, we hate this song, but y'all love this song, and then they'll play the song.
Yeah, fan service
right
at that point. But that's the only song you're really going to hear on the radio. That's the song that's going to be on the soundtrack of, you know, a comedy that's out in 2019.
Right.
But then beyond that, it's and I tried to, with the streaming thing, I was like, oh, let's see what their top Spotify songs are. And then you look and you're like, these are all from recent albums.
Cause, yeah.
Yeah, because none of those.
Oh, you cannot stream either of those first two albums?
No.
Maybe the first three or something.
Good God, albums. That's like all of their kind of iconic.
Yeah, for sure. Right. And it's because of that clearance thing.
Wow. I guess I should have kept those mix CDs that Joran made.
There you go.
but Oliver, what would you say are then, you know, obviously there's that Me, Myself, and I top tier. What would you say then beyond that?
I think Say No Go, which is the song that uses the Hall & Oates. I would put I Know up there, but that's just a personal favorite. That's a song that uses a combination of the Mad Lads and I think more better known as Stilly Dan's Peg is on there.
I know this, but not because of all my earthly treasures or regardless to the fact that I'm past the noose, but because...
That was a song off of 3 Feet when I first heard that album on my first time listening through. That was the moment, the song, I'm like, all right, whatever else I listened to, I just want it to sound like this. So I Know for me, I don't think it would make most people's like maybe top 10 list of De La Soul songs, but it'd be my number one for sentimental reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Stakes is High, the title track from Stakes is High, that probably might make it on there.
That's why the Native Tongues has officially been reinstated.
Saturday.
Oh yeah, roller skate named Saturday. I think it's like one of their like just an all-time great hip hop party song.
It really is a roller skate jam.
It really is.
It is. Yeah. That's a. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want to go in an oval? Do you want to skate in an
Strap
oval?
Strap them
today?
On and go in that oval.
You
as the saying
in the oval,
goes,
baby.
Next category is commercial success, which you know,
did okay,
did fine. You know, sold 5 million records, which you know, in comparison to some of the artists we've talked about, is quite a bit. We just did the Carpenters, which was 90 million. So you know,
not so much.
But they're also you know they're in the top. Yeah, of all time.
Right.
Yeah. 5 million, especially for an artist, artists that are maybe a little more inventive and challenging and artistically credible, to sell 5 million records, that's something.
I mean, I know 3 Feet High went gold. Did they actually go? It went platinum eventually.
It went platinum,
that's impressive. Okay.
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah, and then De La Soul's Dead went gold, and it was diminishing kind of after that.
Right.
Also, now I'm going to think about skits for a second.
I'm just going to
have a little muse for a heartbeat.
Yeah.
But like thinking about two kind of album culture and tape culture and thinking about how much the medium affects the music and like something about like having skits and having them like as part of the track is very tape culture to me. Like, you know, because you're not, it's not like on a CD where you're skipping around.
Right. It's a linear listening experience.
It's a linear listening experience, much in the way that an album is, but to me, even more so, because you cannot stop on a stupid song. You're just like, fuck. All right. You know, you just are going to listen to songs you don't even like. You're going to listen to,
I will say this much. I think for those of us who grew up listening to cassettes, we got very good at kind of being able to figure out how many seconds on the fast forward was necessary to move you in terms of minutes within a song.
And based on your own, you know, cassette player.
Right.
I mean, I remember I had a Walkman as a child, but I remember being like, I would get singles for that reason because I was like,
singles.
I don't want to listen to anything I don't want to listen to. I want to listen to Everybody by Black Box, and then I want to listen to the remix on the other side.
Oh, my God.
You need that auto-reverse function on the on the cassette player.
Oh, yeah, the one that
player.
Would make it flip over?
Yeah,
I
so
had
you didn't
it.
Have to pop that out. Yeah.
I had it.
Next
92 Dodge Shadow. What's up?
Oh, my God.
That was my first car.
Next category is longevity. In the phrase we're starting to use now is imperial phase.
Oh, yes.
Which is coined by, you know.
Chris Melanfi from Hit Parade. Yeah.
That's his term.
Yeah, shout out to Chris.
Great term. So they're kind of imperial phase, 89 to 96, which is 3 feet high and rising until about their fourth album.
Right, the first four albums.
That's kind of the
right.
where they're on top. Even though the 2000 album Artificial Intelligence, Mosaic Thump, seemed to do pretty well,
right.
charted it in the top 10 albums, which was the first time that happened for them.
Right.
So not too bad, about 7 years or so, and they're still around, still putting stuff out, still, you know, doing...
Crowdfunding their albums.
Kickstarters, yeah.
Yeah.
That is wild to me.
Yeah, that they did a Kickstarter, and, you know, they obviously got, I think it was six times what they were asking for to make an album that ended up being fine, right?
Yeah.
Fine to not great.
I mean, I love De La, did not love that album, but,
yeah.
you know, what are you going to do?
Did Garden State 2 ever get made?
Yeah, it was. What was it called? That was crowdfunded as well.
Was that
Kraft?
Was like the
but
big
was it,
one.
Was it a
was
real?
Like
was
Zach
an actual Kraft. Sequel?
It no, was no, just, no, 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 no. Yeah. It was like called When You See Me or something.
Right.
What?
It was called like Wish I Was Here or
yeah.
some
okay.
title like that. That was like.
Did it come out?
I haven't thought
so.
Of Zach Braff in years. Like, what is that dude doing these days?
He had a show on television that my friend was on. That's why.
Okay.
He had a podcasting show.
Season, yeah, about a podcast that I love. He had, but
that
the,
sounds
the
very
show
on brand
was not
for,
good.
For,
right.
It did
yeah.
not seem to be good.
No.
But it was from one of my, it was based on
I
those.
Think we need a Braff renaissance soon.
No, I
that
don't know. Honestly, we don't.
You can stay in your corner with that.
Yeah, honestly, we don't. Oh. We don't. He can, I mean, he can
ouch.
Do whatever
if
he
you
wants
could come
to,
up
but like
with...
what the world needs now is not the renaissance of Zach Braff. Like,
you could come up with a
whoever
good
the
word
woman
for
was
it.
On that show, maybe.
Like if you could get a McConaissance, but if you could do it for Braff.
That's
or like the way we're having a Keanu Sance right now, too. Big
right.
time.
Yeah.
Are you here for that, though?
Yeah.
Oh, who isn't?
Come
yeah.
on. He's America's sweetheart right now. Everybody
it's
loves
very true.
Keanu.
The next category is innovation influence, which we've
oh,
talked
yeah.
about, you know, where...
The whole nine, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Super innovative, super influential, kind of across the board, especially within, I think that can't be stressed enough, within the genre of hip-hop
right.
At the top, you know, up there with nearly any other group you could think of among the most innovative and influential.
I would say absolutely yes.
Straight lines from De La to Kanye as far as like production
oh,
and
sure.
content are concerned
right.
and kind of to everything that we think of as like I don't know. I think of what we think of as like interesting hip hop. You know, they took hip hop and made critics think of it more as art.
Right. I think really one of the first really important hip hop concept albums. And so whether I don't think, you know, if you were to interview Kendrick, I don't think he would say, oh, I came up with Good Kid, Mad City because I was listening to De La. I'm almost positive he wouldn't say that. But I think you can draw basically a kind of informal lineage between that album and something, or really to Pimp a Butterfly would be an mm-hmm. even better example, and then trace that back to something like 3 Feet High as pioneering a particular way of thinking about how to do a hip-hop album that's not just about a bunch of singles, but really about like listening to it as an album as
mm-hmm.
a whole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been coined the Sgt. Peppers of hip-hop.
Really?
I've seen that.
Okay.
I've read that.
Yeah, I can okay. see that.
Last category, maybe the most important. Does my mom know who they are?
My mom doesn't.
My mom does not.
Absolutely not. Jackie's a no on that one.
And so that's maybe what makes this a little bit of an uphill climb for De La, because you know that category is meant to represent name recognition.
Right.
And you don't, especially recently in the classes that we've seen of inductees, you don't see too many artists that don't have that kind of name recognition. Although I think it could happen. Why don't we get to the verdict? Should De La Soul be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Will they? And if so, when? And we'll start with Kristen.
I think they should. I think they will, but it's going to be one of those ones. It'll be like the Zombies almost. Not like in the exact sense that like the Zombies were as influential as De La Soul was, but in the like,
in the sense
whoa,
it's going to take some
it
time.
It took 30 years. Like,
do you think it's going to take 30 years?
I do. I mean, maybe not 30, but I think what you were saying about them being in the top 15 or 20, mm-hmm. I think it's going to take 10 years, 15,
at least, yeah.
maybe. I think we're looking at 10 to 15 years.
Okay.
just because the way the thing works, you know. And I think we've got other people that are more known to the voting body that are going to make the case.
Even within the genre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, Oliver, what do you think? Should? Well,
obviously, yes, I think they should.
Mm-hmm. That's why you're here.
Yes, I think they will, but I'm not able to handicap how long it'll take because I don't understand sort of that system nearly as well as the two of you do.
Yeah.
I think I would like to hope that it would be sooner than, let's say, you know, 10 years into their eligibility. I think if they make it onto a nominations ballot, I would actually think that their odds are actually pretty good if they can make it to that point.
Think of Shaka. Think of poor Shaka. Think of how many times she's been nominated.
Or LL.
I mean.
Yeah, but I can't really explain the Rufus and Shaka Khan like exclusion because that does seem very odd, especially given the history of Rufus as a band within the world of rock before they made the turn towards soul and funk. But I think De La, because they were really always far more of a set of critical darlings than they were commercial darlings. And I think for that reason, it kind of gives them added credibility. But on the flip side, maybe it is also kind of a generational thing in terms of, well, who's voting, you know, for them, you know, within the voting body.
And the word fame sometimes gets bandied about, you know, it's like. Mm-hmm.
But they're not super obscure.
They're not obscure to many, but to many they are.
And you have to think about who's voting, right? It's members of the Moody Blues who are in their 70s. Do they care or know about De La Soul? I don't know.
But I kind of feel like if they did know anything about him, it would be a positive association.
You'd think. But I think it was last year during when the ballots were out, someone from the Hollies was like, I don't know anybody on this ballot except for the Zombies. That's all I'm voting for. And I was like, this is great. These are the people who need to be voting for this thing.
Joe? Thoughts?
Yeah, my verdict is I think they should. And I think they will. Like I said, I think they're going to be in the first 15 acts of hip-hop to be inducted. But I don't think we're going to get a hip-hop act every year necessarily. And, you know, I think it's going to be more than 10 years, unfortunately. 10 to 15, I think, is where I would put it. Because I think once we get through that first, like I said, the icons, like Biggie and Jay-Z and Eminem, I think De La, along with Tribe and Wu-Tang and Snoop, I think they're going to be in the conversation.
Can I turn the tables for a moment?
Could you?
Ooh.
Do you think that there will one day be a hip-hop Hall of Fame?
I definitely do.
And will have the same stature relative to the community in which it represents?
I think it's hard to create those things now. I think one of the reasons why the Rock Hall endures is it's been around for a long time. And I think without trying to do that now in a more cynical culture is hard to do, to establish this is going to be a Hall of Fame. Everyone's going to shit on it on Twitter. Like everyone is going to be pretty cynical about it. So I think it's hard to do. There was a thing called the Hip Hop Honors on VH1, which is kind of close to that. They don't do that anymore. I don't think. They could bring it back.
Because VH1 does it exist anymore? What's going on?
I mean, they did it as recently as 2017.
Really?
So, but, you know, does that mean it's over?
The honors, I think of that as different than a hall. I think that they will create some sort of thing. I think we're looking at it, though, 20 years from now. When it's been around long enough and, like, known long enough. I talk about this all the time on the show about how I think that hip-hop is counterculture now.
It is rock and roll.
It is rock and roll. What rock and roll used to represent is what hip hop represents right now, which is the music that scares your parents. Right. Like that is what it is. And that is, so I think, you know, years from now, it'll be like, we'll be looking back on the 80s, 90s, and it'll be the, you know, 50s, 60s of, you know.
It's also possible that the Rock Hall will evolve to a point where we are inducting more than one hip hop act in a year, where that just is the inevitability.
But then do you think that there will ever come a time that they would rebrand?
No, I think you can still call it rock and roll because it's the kind of spirit of rock. It's the attitude of rock. Although, you know.
Was that the Ice Cube speech?
Yeah, that hip hop is an attitude. That's what he said, kind of directly to Gene Simmons in a sense, because Gene Simmons loves to come out of the woodwork and talk about how hip hop doesn't belong in the hall. All right, let's say they get in though.
Okay.
De La Soul is getting inducted. Who gives the speech to induct De La Soul? I think my thought is an artist that they kind of broke who feels to me like he was created in a lab to give a Hall of Fame induction speech, which is Common.
Oh.
That's a good call.
He seems like someone the people who run the Rock Hall would already know.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, would have his number, and he would do it.
I think that's a good call. I would say, I think Chuck D is a distinct possibility as someone mm-hmm. else who is from Long Island. I mean, would have known those guys coming up.
And
he has a certain stature.
And he has shown up, and you know, he inducted the Beastie Boys. He has been inducted himself.
Yeah.
He plays the game with the Hall. I think Mos Def, given his connection to the group,
yeah.
and his stated influence.
But I guess I wonder if that is a big enough of a get for the Hall.
Yeah, I think he would maybe give the most passionate speech. I don't know, just because what he has said about how he's been influenced by them.
Right, right.
I mean, there's a lot of people in that Native Tongues circle, Queen Latifah, Q-Tip, you know.
Any of those people, obviously, you know, the Kanye or Kendrick, too, if you could get them.
They should get someone from the Turtles. That'd be amazing.
That's what I was thinking.
Oh, my gosh.
What if it happens that they get inducted with the Turtles same year?
Oh, my God. Wait, the Turtles are not in?
They're not in, no.
Wow.
That's karma, too. Fuck those guys. What did the Turtles do?
Happy Together.
Oh, okay. Anything else?
And then, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You.
Eleanor. They had some jams.
They had some stuff.
King Kamehameha. Big drum break got sampled a lot too. They probably sued people over that. Anyways.
Yeah. Good guys. De La Soul gets inducted. What's a good 3 or 4 song set that they play at the ceremony?
They play side one. They do all the skits. Yeah.
Well, I think obviously me, myself, and I, they have to play.
Do they though? I don't know. How does that work? Like, how do bands strategize what they play?
So I think of it.
Joe has a theory.
Usually,
we don't know truly.
No, I mean, like, it's up to them. I think the Hall makes some strong suggestions, but I think typically a group would want to pick from different albums to kind of give an idea of the arc of their career.
Right.
Right. Not to just, because you could have a great set of all stuff from 3 Feet High, but you know, you would want, I think, because it's about. It's essentially a lifetime achievement award. You would want to pick from different years, from different albums.
I mean,
they did a song with Chaka Khan. If they get inducted the same year as her, they do that one.
On a baby grand, transmitting like you made a man, but you paint a funny face like a chick. When I see you, I'm gonna tell you quick that I'm
ain't all good. That's true. Things ain't going like they should.
So. I mean, the complication here is I don't think they perform anything off of those early albums until Tommy Boy clears their stuff. So I think as a political gesture, they would refuse to play anything off of albums that have not been basically licensed or released for streaming.
Oh, interesting.
Oh my gosh. Well, do you think this could be the turning
point,
though?
They can't profit from it either.
Yeah.
So what would be the point? Like there's both artistic and political and commercial reasons not to perform any of that early stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe getting inducted is a compelling reason why Tommy Boy would finally pony
to finally
up.
Do it. Yeah.
Because
this could be it.
Right. So, maybe okay, fine. Let's assume that
the event of their induction is worthy right. enough to finally clear.
So maybe they do. Maybe they do like Me, Myself. Maybe they do three's a magic number.
Sure.
Maybe they do Ring, Ring, Ring off of De La Soul is Dead.
Hey, how you doing? Sorry they can't get through, but what if your name and your number? I'll get back to you. Yo, check.
And maybe they go like deep cut with like I Am I Be off of the third album, off of Balloon Mind State.
Go a little something like this. Look, Ma, no protection. Now I got a daughter named Ayana Monet. And I can play the cowboy to rustle in the dough so the scenery is healthy with her eyes lit. I am an early bird, but the feathers are black, so the apples that I catch are usually all worms. But it's a must to decipher one's queen from a worm who plays groupie and spread around the bad germ.
Yeah.
Or Ego Trip in Part 2. That'd be kind of hot, too.
Big truck, a man's rolling in town. How you do? How you do? I got the chart to make you jump because I'm heading eastbound. Tired of the merry-go-round and around. And everybody's talking about your stuff funny, but they still tell a lie to me. I got the trees in my backyard, and it's hard for them to tell a lie to me. And who's the foot? I'm the foot, but who's stepping?
I think that sounds like, here's the deal. If De La Soul, and I'm pointing at Oliver in
an aggressive
way.
Point. Yeah. That's a Public Enemy point. That is not a De La point.
If De La Soul gets inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, would you go to the induction ceremony? With us?
With us. keep that? Does that sweeten or soften?
if that makes it a worse deal, you can take us out of the equation.
Sure.
Wouldn't that be to find, especially because you're kind of skeptical about their odds and, you know, the Hall in general.
Yeah.
To see that, wouldn't that be sweet?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm not opposed to the existence of the Hall. Whatever my feelings are, it has nothing to do with, like, the Hall as an institution. It has to do with the discourse around the Hall, in the same way that are with the Grammys. Well, actually, no, I just kind of think the Grammys as an institution are kind of fucked up. But mm-hmm. like, it's one of those things where when I feel like people care too much about, like, who gets a Grammy, I'm kind of like, who cares who gets a Grammy? Because why are we giving
like
a Grammy?
Who cares about the Rock Hall
but,
over here?
Right.
The reason I think the Rock Hall has a leg up on the Grammys is that if you fuck something up with the Grammys, it's fucked up for history. You don't give this album if you don't give a specific album the award you want to give it, you can never give that album.
Right. You've missed the opportunity. The Hall can always make it up later.
There's always hope.
Right. Right.
Like I always say, there's always hope in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
There you go.
Oliver, thank you so much for being a part of this.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I really appreciate it. And I want to give you a chance to plug your own shit.
Yeah, so I co-host a music album appreciation podcast called Heat Rocks. Every episode we have a guest on to talk about one of their favorite or most formative albums. We release it every week. You can find that at heatrockspod.com or heatrockspod on Twitter, on Instagram. And much like this show, once a week I get to talk about music with smart people, which is super fun.
Mm-hmm. And this one you got to talk with dumb people.
Yeah.
No. This was a very smart conversation. So
thank you.
Yeah.
And do you want to plug your books or anything? You wrote. You edited a hip hop guide.
I did. I wrote. I edited a hip hop album guide called Classic Material, the Hip Hop Album Guide, which came out, God, like 15, 16 years ago. I was able to get some of my favorite writers to contribute to it. It's long out of print, so you find it in your local library, maybe. I also wrote an academic book. My day job is I'm a sociology professor. I wrote a book called Legions of Boom, Filipino-American Mobile Disc Jockey Crews of the San Francisco Bay Area, which I'm very proud of, though. Actually, I was going to say, like, maybe people wouldn't be interested in it, but why wouldn't you be interested about Filipino-American Mobile Disc Jockey Crews of the San Francisco Bay Area?
I'm interested. Right. Someone should make a freaking doc.
You know what? People have approached me over the years, and it's one of those things where I think if it was a bigger topic that could get instant funding, then it would have already happened. But it's one of those, like, very labor of love. But it is very, very doc worthy. I'm biased, obviously, but there's so much there. It's like a hip hop story.
Like, Rise,
the
Crump documentary. Yeah. Rise, like, I feel like that. It feels similar. A very local scene vibe thing, to me,
right.
Like about like learning totally. About a local scene and learning. Mm-hmm. Check it out, guys. Rise. It's a good one. It's where Lil C, the crump dancer, got a start. Tommy the Clown. He was at the last.
Oliver, where can we find you online?
So besides like the handles for the podcast, I'm on Twitter at Oliver S. Wong. And then my website, which has been around for ages, soul-sides.com.
Incredible.
Also, you can find his news group, Rec.
Yes. You can find archives of me writing about Illmatic stupidly back from in 1994 online somewhere.
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at RockHallPod, RockHallPod@gmail.com. Send us a message. If you want Kristen to see it, you're going to have to designate that in the subject line. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. Rate and review us. 5 stars only. If you're leaving a review because of this episode, you should say...
say something mean about Skits.
Yeah, mention Skits and be mean about it.
That's a grand takeaway from it. It's not about De La Soul. It's about how bad rap Skits are.
Skits can eat shit.
They really can.
Thank you to Michael Boyd for the logo, Yusu Kim for the music. Thank you to Joe Devine for the equipment. Thank you to Chad Briggs and Dave Schilling for letting us record in the home that I share with them. Thank you to Pantheon Podcast for hosting us. Christian, we're glad you're safe and well. I'm Joe Quazala.
I'm Kristen Studdard.
And who cares
about the Rock Hall?
Est-il? Quelle heure est-il? You showed me how to do exactly what you do, how I fell in love with you. It's true. Oh, I love you.
Progressive presents Adjusting to the Suburbs.
It never dawned on me how much walking I used to do until I bought a house in the suburbs. Like when I'd say, I'm going for coffee, of course I was walking. But now it's like 3 miles and no latte's worth that. I find myself inviting people on walks with me like it's a scheduled activity. This morning, my neighbor asked me what I'm doing and I actually said, I'm going for a walk with Nancy.
Anyway, when you save with Progressive by bundling your home and auto, that's the easy part of adjusting to the suburbs. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company. Coverage provided in service by affiliates and third-party insurers.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.